Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 346th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. And by satellite link from Mars, we have Adrian Lindblad to regale us with evidence of pregnancy and puking. Because there's a puke score, right?
There is a puke score. That's right.
That's
absolutely.
Yeah, it wasn't something derogatory. It was actually, I'm just being scientific now.
Yes. Yeah. And there is, and you know, I don't think you want to be puking when you're on Mars. That'd probably be really messy.
not in your helmet.
Yeah, not in your helmet.
So on our previous podcast, when we were talking about nausea, vomiting in pregnancy, we went through, I think, as much of the evidence as there is for diclectin. And maybe if you could just let the listeners know, where did we come? What was the end result of that, other than complete confusion?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the end result was really that diclectin is likely very safe in terms of how well it works. Well, the evidence has been pretty not good, but probably it works about, improves about symptoms for about 1 in 10, or pardon me, 1 point improvement on about a 10-point scale. For global assessment is probably how well it works. And we just talked about how a lot of the evidence is at very high risk of bias. It hasn't always been really well done.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Or even published,
yes.
Yeah, until recently.
Until 40 years later, yeah.
So we got a few other options. We got B6 and ginger on Dancitron and stuff. So why don't we just quickly run through that evidence?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's important to do that because a lot of criticism that's come up of diclectin lately, people say, well, hey, I'm just going to use this other drug instead. And I think it's important to then look at, do the other drugs actually work that much better than diclectin? So I think the first one people often wonder about then is B6 alone, and can we use B6 alone? So we've got, I think it's about 4 systematic reviews looking at how well B6 works on its own. And the Cochrane review actually said it probably best, calling vitamin B6 difficult to interpret. And they said it was because sometimes B6 is the active intervention in studies, sometimes it's the control, sometimes it's taken in addition to another intervention. So there's one study, for example, where it was the combination of metoclopramide plus B6, and I think that was compared to prochlorperazine. So it's really sometimes difficult to know exactly what is being studied and what is the effective part out of all of this.
But there were some placebo-controlled trials, though.
There were, yeah. There's 2 randomized controlled trials compared to placebo. And when they've combined these in meta-analysis, there doesn't seem to be really any difference. So the mean difference on nausea was about 0.92 and the confidence interval range from 0.4 to 1.44. And for vomiting, relative risk, I think, was 0.76, and it ranged from 0.35 to 1.66. So when you combine the studies for B6 alone compared to placebo, it doesn't look like it's any better than placebo. But if you look at the studies and the individual components alone, you do start to see a little bit of benefit. So a lot of these used a 10-point visual analog scale, and they found B6 might be better for nausea, like changing at 2.9 versus a change of 2. Might be a little bit less vomiting, although that wasn't statistically significant. And it sort of continues the inconsistent pattern that we kind of talked about with diclectin, that some outcomes seem to do a little bit better and some don't seem to do so good. There's also a randomized controlled trial that compared B6 to diamine hydronate. The study was done in Iran. It actually found that diamine hydronate was better than B6. And we also have a randomized controlled trial from Malaysia that compared B6 to placebo, but in this case, the placebo was actually mint Tic Tacs. So it was kind of an interesting choice of placebo. and they found no difference between the mint Tic Tacs and the B6.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that you should pretty much just do mint Tic Tacs for all placebos, because then you can totally tell that there's no way you could figure out that was a placebo.
Definitely not. Definitely not. But your breath would be fresh.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what else do you really need?
Exactly.
And it's a study about vomiting, so really, that's probably a good thing.
So what's... go ahead.
Sorry. No, I was just going to say, and then that that big 8-way study that we talked about on the last podcast with diclectin. So that was the study that had people could be randomized to doxylamine, pyridoxine, dicyclamine, or placebo, or any kind of combination of all of those. They didn't do any statistical analysis, and the numbers aren't given to us to make much of an analysis. But if you do look at the data for vitamin B6 compared to placebo, there didn't seem to be much of a difference there. There was maybe some improvement on the nausea scale when the physician assessed the outcomes, but there wasn't an effect on vomiting or overall effectiveness, and there wasn't a difference when patients discussed or patients assessed if the symptoms were better. B6 wasn't any better than placebo on there.
So certainly not overwhelming evidence.
Not overwhelming. Yeah, no, yeah. Definitely not overwhelming. But again, it's these studies are all very, they're generally very small, not always very well done. So it's, sometimes it's very difficult to know how much of it was just the way the study was done.
Yeah, okay. So what about ginger? Yeah.
All right, so ginger is another really interesting option because I think women like it because it's considered natural and it's, everybody thinks that it's safe and wonderful and going to cure everything. So we have 7 systematic reviews of randomized controlled trials. We don't have any results that have actually been meta-analyzed, though, and this is where we start to look at and see more of the different scales that have been used for nausea and vomiting. So you can look at number of vomiting episodes, how many hours you were vomiting, how many hours you were nauseous, how many nauseous episodes. You have all these different rating scales, like the puke scale that Mike mentioned before. They really couldn't, and it is actually called the puke scale. You really couldn't meta-analyze all of these results. But if we do look at just the number of tests that have been done, one example would be the Cochrane review. They did 12 different analyses and 8 were positive, saying ginger worked. So at best, it probably improves nausea and vomiting, probably about 4 points on a 4-point scale compared to placebo. So that's kind of about 10%, which is sort of similar to what B6 did. But it did seem to have quite a bit of efficacy for stopping vomiting. And it stopped vomiting for about 1 in 3 women at 6 days. There have been a number of studies trying to compare ginger to other therapies, and they all kind of found that they're all the same. So it was kind of the same as B6. It was kind of the same as ondansetron. It was kind of the same as doxylamine and pyridoxine or diclectin. Not all of these studies were actually powered to find a difference, which is tricky, but that is what the evidence is telling us. So the other concern, of course, with anything in pregnancy is just that issue of safety. And the largest cohort study looking at safety of ginger had about 1,000 women in it, and it said that there didn't seem to be any fetal harm when ginger was taken. But some of the smaller studies have kind of found the opposite. So one cohort of about 440 women actually found there was a trend to more stillbirths of 2.7% versus 0.3%. And there was also an increase in major malformations, 3.3% versus 0.7%. So, like I said, this is a smaller cohort, and some of their numbers were almost artificially low. So, for example, that major malformation rate of 0.7% is a lot lower than what most studies of malformations suggest exist, which is maybe closer to 4%.
Yeah, and I'm never a big fan of using the word trend anyway, because it's tricky to know what to do with that. You know,
exactly.
And, nothing that I'm seeing there shows that it's anything more impressive than B6 or diclectin or anything, but it seems like it's just a consistent finding that the evidence is tricky to interpret. And if there is any benefit, it's about a one point on a 10-point scale or 4 on a 40-point scale. So, but we do have one other medication.
We do. We have one other one that seems to cause the most controversy, even more than diclectin, I think. But that is ondansetron. And I remember I first got interested in ondansetron with my last pregnancy, and my family doc suggested it to me. And we kind of went, hey, I wonder what the evidence is. So that's sort of what started this little garden path trip for me. And of course, for me, personally, I always kind of worry about safety first. So let's talk about maybe the safety of ondansetron first. So we've got a number of different studies. They haven't all looked at the same safety outcomes. They've looked at different ones. And some of them were kind of more fishing expeditions, just trying to find risks. But if we look at cleft palate as an example, this is a good example of the inconsistencies in the data. So 5 different studies have specifically looked for an increased risk of cleft palate with ondansetron. One found an increased risk of cleft palate. One found that lovely trend again, but a trend to risk. One actually found that ondansetron prevented cleft palate, and two studies found nothing at all. So just a good example again of this inconsistencies with cleft palate. Cleft lip has never been an issue. It's just been cleft palate.
And part of the problem with all of these types of studies, they're all going to be cohort trials. There's a huge Absolutely. Problem of publication bias, and mm-hmm. boy, it is tricky to know how to deal with those sorts of things. It's unfortunately it really is the only way to look at this sort of question. But when you had one mm-hmm. study finding an increase and one preventing, and it basically, you really can't hang your hat on any of that.
Absolutely. And that is some of the nice thing with some of the other medicines, like when we go back to Diclectin, is that everything has been fairly consistent saying it doesn't cause a problem. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, it just gets a little bit messier. Mm-hmm. Another concern with ondansetron has been renal defects. And this is renal agenesis, dysplasia, or obstructive defects. Two different studies have looked at this, and they actually both found an increased risk, although this really was based on very small numbers, so I think it was like 5 cases out of a couple of hundred. But it was statistically significant, of course. And another issue that's come up quite a bit with ondansetron is the risk of heart defects. And this is where I think things get most confusing with this medication. So there's been 3 studies. Two of these studies found an increased risk of heart defects. These were likely septal defects, but we don't know for sure that's what they were, because it's not always well defined in the literature. And the largest study showing that there was a potential problem is unpublished, and I think we'll come back to that one in a minute here. In terms of studies that found no risk at all, we have 3 studies that found there's absolutely no risk at all with ondansetron, including one that was probably the highest quality studies of all of these. It was published in the New England Journal, and it had it was based on some large databases out of, I believe it was Denmark. And it was quite well done, showed there was actually no risk of harm. Going back to the heart defects problem, though, we have this one large heart defect study that's not published, and it used the same database as the big study that showed there's no problems at all with ondansetron. They just use slightly different years from what we can tell. But because it's only published as an abstract, there's so much information that's missing to know what the differences are between these 2 studies that found no risk or possible risk. The one that did find this risk, the one that's unpublished, had an odds ratio of 2. And that's, unfortunately, pretty much all I can tell you about it.
It's tough.
There might be some risk. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really tough to try to figure out what to do with all this stuff. And this basically applies to almost all information around pregnancy and harm associated with anything. It is very tricky to do. But I guess one of the questions is, though, that's sort of the safety aspect, and it looks like it's being looked at. But how effective is it?
Well, it I think it works. That's the tricky thing.
That's
with this
exciting.
One, is that ondansetron probably has some of the better efficacy data out of all of our different medications. So we've got 3 systematic reviews, really on similar 3 studies, all comparing it to metoclopramide. 2 of these randomized control trials had about 70 to 160 women, and they found no difference between the 2 medications. Of course, there was 1 study, a bit smaller, with 83 women. It was inconsistent. Didn't seem to be much better on day 1 and day 7 than metoclopramide, but was better on day 3 or something else. So a little bit of inconsistencies there. And there was an RCT actually comparing ondansetron to doxylamine or pyridoxine. It wasn't Diclectin in this case. It was the 2 individual components. And the dose of the doxylamine was low. It was about half the dose that we normally use in practice, and it wasn't the sustained release form. So some people have kind of criticized that study because it maybe wasn't a totally fair comparison. But they did find that ondansetron was better for nausea, maybe no difference in vomiting. But that was not an industry-sponsored study, and it was actually quite a well-done randomized control trial. So it gave us some good hope that ondansetron is an effective medication.
And it's interesting, any thoughts on why they chose to compare it to metoclopramide? Because that's not even in our list of drugs that you're talking about.
I don't know. A lot of people actually advocate for the use of metoclopramide. Metoclopramide has some really good safety data. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it's been studied and showing it's actually probably totally safe. And a lot of the data actually shows as well it's very effective. The problem, of course, with metoclopramide, it does have some long-term side effects like extrapyramidal symptoms that are not reversible.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people are scared of using it because of that, and rightfully so. But a lot of people have been advocating for it based on its efficacy and safety to the fetus. It just can cause some potential problems for the mother.
Yeah, no, exactly, which is interesting because none of the other ones sort of cause side effects associated to the mother.
Yeah, you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You're right.
So, I mean, I guess on Danceton could have some, but I don't know if they looked at that in those studies.
If they did, it's mostly just kind of your minor side effects, nothing really crazy like that you'd have to worry about long term. Yeah. So
I guess the bottom line is, with all of this stuff, what would you recommend? if it was you, what would you use?
If it was me, well, I to be honest, I used Diclectin in all my pregnancies and it worked awesome and it helped me sleep, so I thought that was great. But when we actually look at what the evidence says, the Cochrane Review has summed it up, I think, as best as possible, even though the Cochrane Review wasn't specifically talking about ondansetron here, but they said that there is a lack of high quality evidence to support any particular intervention. And I think
which is actually the most, in from my personal experience, that's the most common statement in every Cochrane review ever done. And it's
that
not, that's not, a, yeah. And it's not a criticism of the Cochrane reviews. It's just, you know, I think it should be a reflection on what we, from a medical perspective, what we actually know about things is much less than I think what a lot of people think.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I was going to say the Cochrane probably says that about the statin, primary prevention.
Yeah, not
well.
Quite, but I know exactly what you mean.
We need 700,000 more people studied to find the exact same result again. So I agree with you, but you know, and a lot of the harm stuff, I think people really need to keep in context what these studies are. These are, James uses the term cohort trial. They're not really a trial. They're a study. Which,
yes, I'm sorry, Mike. I do it. I've only been doing that for 346 podcasts.
Years. And the thing is that they're not an experiment. They have no basis in causation, and you need consistent results with large effects, a mechanism which can be described, blah, 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 blah. And these consistently lack that. When you look at the ginger ones, for example, a cohort study of 441 women is small.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely not robust enough to really make decisions, especially when it disagrees with a larger cohort study. So the fact that the results are inconsistent, the fact that they're tiny, that, you know, et cetera, there's just not a lot of reliable data there around harm. Maybe when we're talking about Diclectin, we get better numbers and a few others, but even then the data is not really what we would call robust. So we have to make decisions. Yeah. And I think all this stuff probably has some effect, and some maybe a little more, maybe on ondansetron a little more. Ginger has a suggestion of stopping vomiting for 1 in 3 women in 6 days. That's impressive, but also I would suspect at high risk of bias. So I think you let women choose. You give them some options. Let them choose the way they would like to try. And if it doesn't work, this is a good thing about these kind of problems. If it doesn't work, you can switch to something else.
So, Mike,
relatively.
If I asked you the definitive question that most healthcare professionals get all the time is, what would you use?
Well, when I've been pregnant before,
yes,
I have used Diclectin, but that's because I didn't know well about the other evidence.
Yeah.
So,
and you weren't actually pregnant; you were just drunk and vomiting.
No, I was bloated, and I thought I was pregnant. It turns out you need a pregnancy test, and I don't think I fully understand how people get pregnant. So I think that might have been some of the problem. And James, you want to start?
How about we'll do a cohort trial on that?
Oh, that would be great. You know, James, I was going to say that you have demonstrated a trend to improving professionalism, but I'm going to remove that. First, because the word trend was used.
Yeah. Exactly.
Secondly, because it was patently false.
So, but getting back to reality here. So, Mike, are you in your practice? What do you usually go with Diclectin first?
That's the one I'm most commonly have used in the past, although now I will add B6 in ginger in that list. I think ondansetron should be there, but I think it should be second or third line due to expense and some other reasons. But I would offer really any one of those three first line. Yeah. And be ready to jump to the next, to another agent relatively quickly. So, and I have the great advantage, patients, you can remind them to follow up, but you'll be surprised even when you do how few actually do follow up with you, like give you a call back in 3 days. So what I'll often do is have my nurse call them and check on how they're doing. And that is very helpful because it kind of assures that close follow-up.
And we do have to realize that you know, extended nausea and vomiting in pregnancy is not without risk either.
Oh, it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah.
You know, this is supposed to be a somewhat happy time. And later on in pregnancy, and Adrian, you can correct me if I'm wrong because I likely will be, but that is not a great fun time either when you're carrying another human around in your front.
Yes.
It's just not a fun time for and anyone. I don't know whether the humans have a good time in the front, but I mean, I feel terrible for moms. They're just, it's hard for them to sleep. They have heartburn. I mean, the list goes on and on. So, why make both the beginning and the end terrible? Mm-hmm. So, I think we need to, and then there's all the things you're indicating, like ending up in hospital and mom's not gaining weight and the risk for babies in that way and adequate nutrition. So, yeah, there's a ton of worries about this. So you can't let it go. I can't prescribe B6 and then I'll see you in 7 weeks or 4 weeks or something. It requires follow-up.
No. Well, that's absolutely great stuff. So we've got, you know, as much as information as we could find on issues or treatments for nausea, vomiting, and pregnancy. Now, we've got just a couple of quick sort of other things to just chat about in pregnancy. So why don't we quickly run through those?
Sure. Yeah. So this one, the next topic is a tricky one, and it is one that I really despise talking about, actually. And that is the use of SSRIs and cardiac malformations. And I find this area so fascinating. We talk about inconsistencies. We can talk about consistencies. We can talk about financial relationships with industries that haven't always been disclosed. And it's like a soap opera when we talk about SSRIs, I think. It's just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. So that's the uses of SSRIs in pregnancy.
You're right. Yeah. Absolutely. And so we've got 9 systematic reviews and a new cohort study that has come out since then. 5 of these studies suggest that there is an important effect, that SSRIs can increase the risk of cardiac malformations. What's interesting about that is that one of those cohort studies was actually sponsored by the pharmaceutical industry, by the makers of one of the SSRIs, and they still felt that there was a risk using these medications. Then we have 5 other systematic reviews saying that the effect is not important, that they're it's either not statistically significant or not high enough to really worry about. Of these 5 studies saying the effect is not important, 4 of them have ties to the industry. And the other one only included 4 studies, which I can't really figure out why they only included those 4. But it's a bit tricky then to try and sort through this when you're going, well, how much of it is this consistency and rot? And if you actually line up all the different hazard ratios and confidence intervals and odds ratios that have looked at, they're all actually fairly similar in terms of a risk anywhere from about 10%, I think, up to 70 or 80%, in terms of a hazard ratio of 1.1 to 1.7, 1.8. It's just whether or not those confidence intervals are quote-unquote statistically significant or not that affects the interpretation. And even some of the ones that do appear to be statistically significant, some of the authors are saying, yes, but it's not important. It's not clinically relevant. And it's very difficult to do that when you're talking about cardiac malformations in cohort studies where you don't even necessarily know what the malformation is. A lot of them are probably septal defects. A lot of them are probably not clinically relevant in terms of they're picked up on an ultrasound, and then they often close all on their own by the time a child is a year old. And we just don't necessarily have that information a lot of time. It might just be, oh, there was a cardiac defect, end of story. But we really need a lot more information to know what the risk was and how clinically relevant it was to the child. And we just don't have that information. So but maybe part of the reason that we're seeing a higher risk with SSRIs is the predisposition bias and the fact that maybe it's depression itself or something about these women that are causing this higher risk of defects, and it's not related to the medication at all. So there was one study, a fairly well-done cohort from the New England a couple of years ago back in 2014, and it was looking at almost 950,000 women. About 7% of them took an antidepressant in their first trimester. And when they first looked at the risk of cardiac defects among all of the women taking an antidepressant, they found a relative risk of about 1.25, which gave you a number needed to harm of about 550, I think it was. But once they started to adjust for the presence of different confounders, different baseline characteristics, and actually adjusting for presence of depression, the risk went down to 1.06, and it was no longer statistically significant. So it certainly seems to say that depression itself might be causing some of these harms that we're seeing with the risk of these medications. Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, again, the problem with a cohort study.
Yeah.
I know.
Sorry.
I was choking
something.
I know. Sorry. You're choking from happiness. when you look at a cohort and then start adjusting for all of the other things that could be sort of these confounders, which is the right thing to do, before you've adjusted for everything, you sometimes see an association that's statistically different, but then it all goes away when you deal with all the confounders. If it doesn't when you deal with all the confounders, then that's certainly better, or at least better in that it might be showing something. But these things are always tricky.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then there's another thing that potentially that pregnancy might have a protective effect on relapse of depression.
Yeah, this one is also fairly tricky, because this is the concept of, well, if we stop an SSRI before someone gets pregnant, the pregnancy will protect them against having a relapse. And so we've got a couple of studies from the last 10 years or so that have looked at this, some cohort studies. One was a cohort of about 200 what they called high-risk women, and I know how much James loves the term high-risk, but in this case what they meant was women who had had a history of depression for at least 15 years. They had at least four episodes of major depression. People who were not someone you would typically want to be stopping an antidepressant in. And what they did find is that in those women who, if you did stop the antidepressant prior to them becoming pregnant, 68% of them did have a depression relapse while they were pregnant versus 26% who continued on their medication. So that was a number needed to treat of about 3.
Now we know what you meant by high risk.
Yes.
68%.
They defined high risk. Good. Yes. and then there was another cohort, a larger cohort of 778 women with a history of depression in the past 5 years, and it didn't seem to make a difference if they were on an SSRI or not, unless they were, I'm trying to not use the word high risk, but they were women who had a more severe history of depression, again, over 4 episodes of depression in the last, I can't remember how many years. So those are the women, again, who... there did tend to be more of a relapse rate if they had stopped their SSRI.
Right. So, Mike, I mean, when you see this data, I mean, what's your approach to, you know, in a woman who is becoming pregnant or going to become pregnant or whatever, and assuming we knew the cause, how do you deal with the antidepressant issue or the SSRI issue?
And we had kind of talked about this at the best science medicine course, and I approach it the same way Tina does. I kind of wait and I see what the issue is. So even if a woman's considering being pregnant and is on a rise, we talk about that a bit, because of course we don't know when the most important exact time is, but it might be early on. So we talk about it and we see how they've been doing. Is this your first bout of depression? What was involved in that? Were they, you know, very severely ill, or was it just needed something to help them get over kind of the hump they were languishing for a while, or what have you? And then we put those things into perspective, and then perform a taper if we think it's quite reasonable to get off. If not, then we continue on. And sometimes I'll try and lower the dose a bit to see if we can maintain some of the benefit of staying on the antidepressant. But often will come off. I have a couple patients who I can think of right away who I would never take off unless the risk was far more dramatic and concerning. The only thing I'll add to that is it's not clear to me from the data, is Paxil really the highest risk, or is Paxil just been studied more? And in the end, what I consider in this is that because I'm not clear, I will ask women who are on Paxil if they really need it to consider using another agent for that period.
It's all tricky. But I did want to add, though, when you complain about my use of the very loosely using the word studies and trials together, I think you saying that, you know, it's when, especially when it's associated with pregnancy, when you say, you know, getting over the hump, I think that might be a little bit of an inappropriate word to use. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, you did trump me there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not even going to go that way or that route. So let's put this all together in a very nice little package. What's the bottom line on all these things?
Bottom line is, well, there's a couple. So the first is the risk of any malformations with medications for nausea and vomiting of pregnancy is extremely low and very inconsistent. And there's nothing there for us to spend a lot of time worrying about. There's no evidence really that one medicine is a lot better than the others, but I don't think it's the same as saying none of them work. I think we still need to treat nausea and vomiting of pregnancy, but for what you use, I think to say you can just sort of pick one, look at costs, look at availability, look at tolerability. And like Mike said, if one doesn't work, follow up and switch them to something else and let them try something else. And then with SSRIs and the risk of cardiac defects, there certainly might be a low risk there. It's very, very low. If your risk of cardiac malformations is maybe 1% in the general population, this at worst raises it to maybe 1.8 to 2, but I don't even think it's that high. And we don't know what the clinical significance of it is, if this is just kind of chance findings that we're getting an ultrasound, or if this actually has any kind of a clinical impact. But again, these are important medicines for a lot of women to stay on, and I think that providing them with some of that education and reassurance if they do require to stay on their medication is very valuable for them.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Adrian, for putting all that together. These questions are very difficult to answer, and for a variety of reasons. One, just the evidence alone, but the nuances associated with trying to find things like birth defects, and it is really tricky. So, you know, I don't think any of this gives definitive answers, but what it does is, as we've always tried to do, Mike, is give the best available evidence, and then you know, all our
clinical... I would say the third reason that it's difficult is because she's working with us.
Well, that is the hardest thing to do.
The main one, yeah.
Yeah. That definitely causes nausea and vomiting.
Absolutely. Every day.
Yeah. But that's really great. And so for those of you who are listening to this podcast, by the time you're hearing it, actually not even by the time, even if you hear it right now, if you were listening, we just finished our Best Science Medicine course. And by all accounts, it was very successful. Mike and Tina and Adrian and a whole bunch of other people did a great job of that. So we really don't have anything to sell at all, other than we would love it if you go to our website. We'd love it if you go to iTunes and leave comments about the podcast. That would be great. And anyway, go to our site, check out all of the other stuff that we're doing. Check out all of the new tools for practice. There's going to be a number coming out in the next few weeks. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.